News time 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour on KPCW. I'm Parker Malatesta. It's currently 36 degrees, a little warmer, 36 in Park City, a little warmer over in the Heber Valley, partly sunny here in Old Town. On the phone with me, I've got meteorologist Thomas Giboy with ABC4. He'll have some info on what's coming up this weekend.
Well, good morning and happy Friday to you. And we got some big changes coming to our weather as we go throughout just the next few hours, because there's a cold front that's currently moving into the western portion of the state. So I'd say that it's fairly mild outside right now. And if you were to just walk outside and look around with some of the sunshine that we have, you might think that it's just going to be a beautiful spring day. And through the first half of the day, it might just be that. But as we go from this morning into the afternoon, that cold front will start to work its way closer to the I-15 corridor. And then by the afternoon, we'll move past the I-15 corridor, moving from west to east. So out there this morning, there will be at least a slight 20% chance of finding a shower. And we'll likely see a temperature climb into the middle 40s in Park City, while we could get closer to 50 degrees down in Heber. But our daytime high today in the Wasatch back is likely going to occur before we get to midday today, because once the front moves through, that the colder air will begin to work its way in. And through most of the afternoon in Park City, we'll likely see a temperature in the 30s, and the chance of wet weather will be increasing. And by this afternoon, we'll be looking at a 90% chance of showers. Could start off as starting with mainly rain, depending on the temperature, but should quickly transition over into snow. And with those winds out of the northwest, it'll be much cooler tomorrow morning compared to what we're waking up to right now, with that overnight low dropping to 22 degrees. So we'll be looking at an 80% chance of seeing some snow. And we'll be looking at much chillier temperatures, with the chance that we see some accumulations tonight, maybe on the magnitude of 1 to 2 inches. For our Saturday, 90% chance of snow showers, with the daytime high coming in at 33 degrees. And we could be looking at some decent accumulations, maybe on the magnitude of 3 to 5 inches in Park City. And we're going to hold on to at least a chance for some snow showers through Saturday night, with the overnight low dropping back to the low 20s. Our storm system that's driving the cold front today will move away from Saturday night into Sunday, but there will be a trailing system that does move in, and we'll hold on to roughly a 1 in 3 chance of seeing some additional snow showers both Sunday and Monday. Otherwise, we'll see partly cloudy skies. With the daytime highs, that will begin to moderate. We should be back in the middle 30s on Sunday, low 40s on Monday. And then as we move into the middle of next week, high pressure will look to set up shop once again. And it's going to be beautiful spring weather as we move from the middle portion of next week into the second half of next week. We'll be back in the middle 40s by Tuesday, low 50s by Wednesday. And then we'll likely see a daytime high back in the mid to upper 30s on Thursday. So we're going back down on the roller coaster right now, and we'll start to climb back up as we move into next week.
Sounds fun. Thanks, Thomas. Have a good weekend.
Likewise.
Now let's find out what all this weather means for the backcountry. On the phone with me, I've got Greg with the Utah Avalanche Center on today's conditions.
Yeah, good morning. You know, the only thing that's certain about spring weather is its uncertainty. So we're looking at quite a storm this coming weekend. And I actually think snow amounts could be under forecast. We have a cold, unstable northwest flow, and in the spring, these storms often do overproduce. So I would not be surprised to see snowfall totals exceeding 2 feet in the mountains by Sunday afternoon. We'll see, obviously. But today we're starting out with a low danger. We've had sun and warm temperatures, and we had some wet avalanche activity earlier this week. But the snow that was going to be shed has come down. So seeing a low danger today. Could rise to moderate in the afternoon. We do have some gusty winds out there, so any dry snow that's out there could get drifted into some shallow wind drifts, and we're expecting a few inches of snow by this afternoon, so there could be some pockets of wind drifted snow this afternoon as well. So right now, going with a low danger, could be rising to moderate during the afternoon, but looking at an increasing danger over the weekend with continued winds and periods of heavy snow. And yeah, you just heard the forecast. Following the weekend system, Sunday, Monday, looks like we're going to be clearing out. And the next 7 to 10 days after this storm look pretty quiet. So certainly April came in pretty stormy, but after this weekend, I think we're going to be seeing some quiet weather and lots of snow out there. And so some sunshine will be welcome by later in the week.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Greg. Have a good one.
Thank you so much. You too. Bye-bye.
Coming up, we'll be speaking with Tara McKee. She's the Deputy Director of Grants and Planning at the Utah Division of Outdoor Recreation, we'll be talking about the first ever Mountain West Trails Conference coming up next month in Vernal. Then Park City Councilmember Tana Tolley will be in studio to have a recap of last night's city council meeting. And we'll end the hour with Laura Kildo. She's the Director of Development for Kids Play International. She'll have details on an event happening at Woodward Park City tonight. First, let's get into some local news. A community event recently celebrated a sweet maple tapping season at Wasatch Mountain State Park. KPCW's Amber Johnson has more on that.
Aspiring hobbyists gathered for a BYOP, that's Bring Your Own Pancake, maple tapping boil down party at the state park last weekend. Many of them attended the park's introductory workshop in February, where they learned to tap from box elder and big tooth maple trees. Fluctuating temperatures above and below freezing create the pressure that causes sap to rise and flow from trees. Once the sap is collected, the fun begins, USU Extension Assistant Professor Wesley Crump said.
That's where we're at right now. We collected sap, and essentially, to make maple syrup, you just boil the crap out of the sap.
When sap comes out of a tree, it contains only 1 to 3% sugar content, plus lots of minerals and water. Generally, it takes about 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup, so the process takes time and energy. The key to a good boil is to cook the sap outdoors over sustained heat, like a fire or propane stove. The syrup is done when it reaches a temperature of 7 degrees above the boiling point of the water. A tool such as a hydrometer or refractometer, which measure the relative density of liquids, should be used because it's a Goldilocks process. If the syrup is boiled too little, it will be prone to spoilage. And if boiled too long, it can crystallize. So what was the verdict of the taste test? Annie Hayes and Wason Foy brought their own pancakes to find out.
It's not super, super sweet like the store-bought stuff is.
It has more of that woodsy taste in it. Mm-hmm.
Would you say, like, good?
Or yeah, it's really good.
I definitely like it better.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah. I like it better than, like, the store maple stuff.
That's not surprising because that store maple stuff is often corn syrup combined with artificial maple flavoring. For PJ Abraham's first season of maple tapping, he collected 25 gallons of sap. He's a forester, so found the whole process fascinating and time-consuming.
It took me anywhere from an hour to an hour and a half to boil down 1 gallon of sap. So I was in it at least 25 hours right there plus.
Was it worth it? His wife said the sweet nectar had a complex flavor with notes of butterscotch, creamy butter, and maple. Abraham even made labels for his sweet nectar and bottled it up.
She asked how fast I'm eating it or what, and if I'm selling it or whatnot, and I told her I'm not even letting my kids eat it.
Because when that liquid gold turns out just right, the reward is especially sweet. Amber Johnson, KPCW News.
On the phone with me now, I've got Tara McKee. She's the Deputy Director of Grants and Planning at the Division of Outdoor Recreation for the state. Tara, how's it going?
Great. Nice to be with you, Parker.
Yes. And before we jump into this conference coming up next month, can you kind of give our listeners some background as to what the Utah Division of Outdoor Recreation does and, like, what does your position entail?
Yes. Division is tasked with a variety of things that encompasses, you know, outdoor recreation from, you know, boating programs, OHV programs, publicity about various topics and, you know, how to stay safe, you know, as we come to the high water season at rivers, good things for families to do out in the outdoors. And then, of course, I've got a great team, and we, you know, as the deputy director over grants and planning, we steward nearly $60 million in annual funding for grant projects around the state. And, these are really vital investments to enhance, you know, that quality of life in Utah that we all love. Provides access to local trails, boating facilities, outdoor ice rinks, and more. And, you know, we know that the tourists are coming here for the recreational opportunities that we provide. But we as Utahns, we love what we have around us. And we want to make sure that every Utahn can get to outdoor recreation opportunities not far from their door. And we know that right now there's an average of 75% of all Utahns participate in outdoor recreation, according to a 2023 USU study. So, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, that demand is being met. And, you know, to lead into this, you know, we've had this focus on trails, which makes up a large demand for those grant infrastructure projects. It's been significant, and, you know, it's widespread popularity. People love getting to their trails, and this emphasis on trail development kind of inspired this creation of this conference. It, you know, so that's where this has started. But
yeah, so you've helped organize this Mountain West Trails Conference, first of its kind in Vernal next month. What's this event all about?
So this is a 3-day conference, and it's got experiences and hand-on education for trail advocates, volunteers, professionals, community leaders from across this 8-state region, also just people who love trails. And by the 8-state region, I mean going down from north to south, Idaho, Montana, Utah, Nevada, Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico, and Arizona. And, you know, there's a great opportunity for attendees from across this 8-state region to enjoy this connection with others, learning from each other. We all focus on maintaining and protecting the trails we love, or perhaps designing and building new trails for both motorized and non-motorized users. We recognize across this region that there's some commonalities with the characteristics and challenges that we're facing for, you know, whether it's trail management, funding, lack of funding, user engagement issues. And, you know, there's this collaborative platform that we're going to have with this conference to address those common challenges collectively. You know, these challenges don't stop at state borders.
Yeah, and, you know, I think everyone certainly here in Park City is well aware of the just rapid growth of outdoor recreation kind of post-COVID. What are kind of some of those top challenges that trail builders and just maintainers are kind of seeing throughout the West?
Throughout the West, I think there's a lot of issues with a lot of miles and miles of trail, not always getting the maintenance they need. There are other places where if only we had a few connections, we could make a super awesome long-distance trail. There are places where trails have too many people on it and they're getting beat up, but yet there's other hidden gems that could take more visitation and trails. So, you know, it, and then there's user conflict issues that need to be worked out. You know, several of the trails are kind of set up for different types of users to use. And lastly, there's also some cool opportunities as technology changes. And we've got e-bikes, right?
Mm-hmm.
That tends to be a hot topic every year. This year, we're going to get into specific trail design considerations that need to be addressed with e-bikes. And also those e-bike, the electric assist technology is really helping adaptive riders to get out there and get onto trails that they normally had to just use their arm strength to get up these trails. And now they can have that e-assist. But are the trails needing tweaks to make it possible for them to enjoy those trails as they go out with their families and friends? So, there's just kind of, we've got some really cool subjects that we're covering. One of the ones that one of the keynote specialist is doing is on how conflict can actually lead to solving of problems.
And does that refer to trail etiquette specifically?
Yeah, well, it can refer to a lot of things.
Right.
Sometimes when people want to put in trails, there's a not in my backyard attitude that comes out at first. We have seen that evolve to the, you know, sometimes the loudest folks end up being, oh, actually, I love this trail. Didn't have those issues that I feared it might have. There's a lot of other things that are going to be available at this conference. We've got topics on even water trails, because that's part of trails, and water trails might be down a river where you have put in takeout spots. So you can go down a river for several hours or a couple days, camp out overnight. And then there are vertical trails with how to climb, access and access to those climbing areas, and little topics on trail photography, trail maintenance fundamentals, that type of thing.
Yeah, covering everything. What attendees, what do you expect that group to be made up of? Is it a lot of people working for different state agencies, or who are you expecting to attend?
Yeah, it's not just state agency folks, although there are several of those. It's, you know, your general trail advocates, like you have locally there in Park City, the Mountain West Trails Foundation, that type of group and their leadership, people that are volunteers, land management agencies, you know, especially with the federal agencies, the U.S. Forest Service and the BLM, and others. There's industry professionals in there, just users, like we have the High School Mountain Biking League folks coming out, but there are these similar mountain bike leagues in other states. There's community leaders, there's tourism folks that help mm-hmm. market these trails. So it kind of covers that gamut, and we expect about 500 attendees.
Why the Vernal location? Was that kind of just the central spot?
Yeah, you know, it's, as you are aware, it's located on the border of Colorado and Utah. That was kind of key to kind of show that these issues cross borders, right? And it's also a gateway community to the Dinosaur National mm-hmm. Monument. Early on, they had a desire to develop trails over the years. I remember, it was well over a decade ago, there was a cover of one of the mountain biking magazines that said, you know, Vernal, the next Utah, the next Moab, because of their development of mountain biking trails. At this day, now Mount McCoy Flats trail system out there is the first congressionally designated mountain bike trail system in the country. And these are kind of things that put a highlight on what Vernal is doing. Mm-hmm. And we thought it would be a great location.
Yeah. Governor Cox, I think, has spoke of a lofty goal of connecting, you know, really creating a statewide trail network. Is it realistic to expect that one day there could really be a broad network across a bunch of states across the West?
Oh yeah, there and some of that has been going on for some time, such as the Continental Divide Trail. But mm-hmm. there are many other types of trails that we are talking about creating. Some of which, most of that infrastructure already exists, and mm-hmm. there's opportunities to just make some connections or solve some of the issues that might make doing those trails difficult, such as access to water. And that's a high need in the Southwest. Governor Cox's initiatives on trails covers both paved and this natural surface. And this particular conference does concentrate on the natural surface trail, but often those paved surface trails are leading folks to those opportunities, right to the trailhead where these hiking trails, biking trails, and so forth are starting. So this is a great initiative with that Governor Cox has started, and many other states are similarly enthusiastic about the opportunities to develop these things in their own state. Why not cooperate across state lines?
Mm-hmm. I did want to steer back over to the e-bike topic, just because our local governments mm-hmm. are kind of reviewing their policies right now. Are there kind of standards you're seeing being set? You know, speed limits have been thrown out. I mean, is it a matter of setting hard rules and enforcing them, or is it more a matter of education, or a mix of both?
I'd say it's a mix of both. There are going to be those who are pushing technology and, you know, the speeds on the e-bikes that may be a problem on some of the trails. But you're going from things that are just pedal assist to something that's veering towards the motorized. And, yes, we have to look at the types of mountain bikes, you know, how they are geared, and what speeds they're capable of reaching, so that we can ensure the safety of all trail users. As far as adaptive cyclists go, because of the Americans with Disabilities Act, they are not subject to those rules. They seldom, you know, go too fast anyway. But because of their need to have that assist, because oftentimes they cannot use their legs to create motion and propel the cycle forward, that is an essential need for them. But as far as this is concerned, we do have continuing a need to be looking at and staying ahead of the technology on the e-bikes, so that people aren't getting used to taking something that's very close to close to the capacities of a lightweight motorcycle mm-hmm. out on trails that are meant to be non-motorized. And on e-bikes, is it, you know, what my, I really want to discuss, because I think these are hot topics. Is there a place where this trail makes sense for e-bike users only, right? So, but what types of levels of e-bikes are appropriate for what types of trails? And I think that's hard, and it's hard to police, but these are things that we're going to be covering at this conference, and hopefully coming up with some common solutions as everybody adds to the discussion.
Yeah, should be interesting. Tara, I'm running out of time. Where can people go to learn more about the conference?
Yes, go to our website at www.recreation.utah.gov and go to our events page, and you'll see the information on this. And love to have your listeners sign up for that and come and be part of these important discussions.
Yeah, and sorry, I don't have the, I know it's next month. Is it the 13th through the 15th? Is that the dates?
It is the 13th through the 15th.
May
and first day is field workshops and field trips and field excursions.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, Tara. We've been speaking with Tara McKee. She's the Division of Outdoor Recreation's Deputy Director of Grants and Plannings. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Jumping into some news real quick, plans for a wellness-focused resort took a step forward Tuesday night as the Midway City Council granted preliminary approval to the next phase of development plans. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports on that.
Amayali, a resort focused on health and wellness, is under construction in Midway at approximately 800 North, 200 East. In late March, the City Council approved a change to the resort's master plan, reducing the number of development phases from 4 to 2. On Tuesday, the Council granted preliminary approval to the plans for that final phase. Phase 1, which includes 24 duplexes and 2 family lodges, was approved in September 2022. It's under construction now. At Tuesday's meeting, City Planner Michael Hinke gave council members an overview of what's next for the development.
So tonight we're really looking at this area that includes the well-being center, the hotel units, and the cottages.
Plans will add 80 hotel rooms and 23 guest cottages to the resort. A spa, a farm kitchen, and the Chobra House of Enlightenment will also be built. The resort is being developed in partnership with Deepak Chopra, famous for promoting alternative medicine. All units will be rentals, which Hinke says will benefit Midway City.
The proposal will benefit the city financially by creating a greater tax base. This is pure hotel rooms, which does help us with the formula regarding meeting the requirements for the resort tax.
Amayali will also build public trails that will connect with Midway's larger trail network. The City Council voted to give the plans their preliminary approval as construction continues on Phase 1. Amayali must secure the Council's final approval to begin building the second phase. The first homes on the resort property could be finished sometime this summer. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
In studio with me now is Park City Councilmember Tana Tolley. Tana, how's it going?
It's going great, Parker. How are you?
I'm great. It's Friday.
And it's really sunny.
And it's really sunny, although I think it's going to get a bit snowy. To start with the City Council meeting yesterday, you all had a work session about a potential remodel of City Hall, but that conversation did take a little turn kind of into some broader questions. What the council discuss?
Yeah, it did take a little bit of a different direction. And so this building, for those that don't know, was the Marsac School. It was built in 1935. What's really interesting about it is it was built during a time when Park City's unemployment and the Utah unemployment was almost 33%. But the city came together along with some of the New Deal that was happening in the federal government and approved a bond to build this school. It was built with, there were 24 classrooms in it. My grandmother attended it in the 1940s. My father attended in the 60s. I actually recently just asked him, where did the buses drop off? And it turns out, like, right where we are, down here.
Bob Wells.
Yeah, this was all just, it wasn't asphalt or anything like that. So it was all just an open field kind of area. So this building is historic. It is, it's six remaining buildings from that time in Summit County. There were seven that were built during that time, and it just has such an amazing history to it. And it has been our city hall since 1983, when the elementary school was moved out to Parley's, and I actually attended Parley's in the 80s. So kind of a big history there of how we had school, and now our city government has been housed there since the 80s. And we're really just busting at the seams. We have almost 375 employees that are year-round. Amazingly, we only actually have six vacancies. So we don't have a lot of openings at the city, but we do have a lot of people. And that's a testament to our previous councils who've done a really good job of being supportive of benefits and salaries, and our city manager as well. So really, at this point, we need to figure out where we're going to house all the people. We know that we need to either move out of there or look at a couple other locations. So what we did decide is that we would move forward with a couple of parts of the remodel. One is a gender-neutral bathroom, which will go on our third floor. The other is adding an AV ramp to the council chambers so that we are compliant with that. And then we've asked our deputy city manager and the team to come back with a list of the IT needs that we have in there. It was mentioned last night that the council, when they're at council chambers, there are six of us and we have six spots. But when you have planning commission or historic preservation board, they have seven. And so they're a little more crammed. So we want to make sure IT, which is changing all the time, is up to date. If you've been there many times when we've said we're having technical difficulties, and we want to just like move into the next level of IT there. So that will come back to us. We also asked that they come back with a current list of city-owned property that could potentially be a new location for City Hall. And then as well as additional pricing on what all of this would cost. How much is it going to be to build something new? Would it make sense to move some departments to another city-owned building, keep some of it here? So really, this is just the beginning of the conversation. We obviously will want to really, really speak with the community and have a lot of community feedback, because this is such a historic landmark legacy building, and we just want to do this the right way and make sure that it's not just a big decision that we make very quickly. So yeah, that's where we are on that one.
Yeah, you know, I've heard tossed out before the public utilities building on Iron Horse being a potential site. Are there any, not to speculate too much, but like, are there any other potential city-owned properties that jump out that could work?
Oh gosh, yes, I've heard the public works, and you know, we're doing this whole small area plan right now to look at that. You know, people have talked about some of the property we own that's on more towards like the Gordo property, Quinn's Junction area. That could be potential. That we do own the Miners Hospital, that could also, maybe some departments could work in there. It really is just going to have to become a bigger overall conversation, though, of do you want to keep everybody together in the heart and soul of the town, or do you want to separate people into different areas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, moving on, microtransit is no longer, I believe it'll be April 14th. Its last day. But the council expressed interest in kind of looking into some new bus routes. So I guess to unpack that, could you kind of explain why the council didn't want to move forward with microtransit?
Yeah, there was a few reasons. One being that when the report came back to us of who was using it, there was a lot of usage. However, 91% of the people who were using it actually lived on a transit route. So the whole concept was that we would have microtransit so that we could service the areas of Park City that were not on a bus route. And so that was one of the big reasons for me, was that we're not seeing the usage from people who live in, say, Upper Park Meadows, Aspen Springs, Royal Street. And so that along with the cost, which is very high, I think they said it's $20 a person per ride. And to compare that, our bus route is about $10 per person. So the cost was one thing. The time was another one. We were, it was taking like over 30 minutes, 40% of the time, which just isn't really an acceptable time frame for people who are wanting to, you know, get to the mountain or go to dinner on Main Street. And so those were some of the big reasons that we said, let's look at doing more of a fixed route in the areas that we're not looking at. So I specifically said we need to maybe look at, like, overall, what does Park Meadows look like? Mm-hmm. It's one of our it's single family homes. It's a lot of residents. And how are we servicing that community? We also know that Royal Street's always been part of that conversation as well. They've had bus service and it's been taken away and then added again. And so want to make sure they're taken care of, as well as what does Quinn's Junction look like? Mm-hmm. And getting, like, you know, do kids need to be going to the ice arena and going out there to play lacrosse or play soccer? And so we're just going to have a little bit more of a robust conversation on bus routes. And that cost was almost, I think it was half of what it would have cost for us to get microtransit to where we wanted it. And then we're also just going to be really, really cognizant of creating metrics and making sure that we, at the end of the day, can measure whether or not this is working. And if it's not, then being really quick to look at a different direction. And we're really excited about our new transit director, and he brings a lot of knowledge and comes from areas that have more innovative things happening there. And so we're really excited to see what he can bring in to us.
And you heard from a local taxi operator last night as well, just speaking about maybe a potential collaboration with the city on transit.
Absolutely. And we did say, please go back and look at what the local transit drivers are doing and how could they assist the city in our transportation needs.
Yeah. The council signed on to the 2030 zero waste goal. Could you kind of tell people what that's all about? Summit County did a similar thing.
Yeah. Summit County beat us by 24 hours. Oh, you know, we're always want to try to be a little bit ahead of Summit County. This is in partnership with the Community Foundation, and it's looking at being net zero waste by 2030. And so for those that don't know, I mean, some of the stuff I learned was crazy, that like one third of all of our food in America gets wasted. It's about $480 billion worth of food and takes 4 trillion tons of water. And so the food waste actually is considered the world's top contributor of methane into the atmosphere, which is actually more potent than CO2. So this, to me, it seems sort of like a low-hanging fruit of something that we can do as a community, where they're looking at maybe getting about 1,000 residents to sign on to this, where they would monthly have their food waste picked up. We would also work in conjunction with the HPCA to start a small business program. And then they would look at also doing a micro digester. We saw that when we went to Sun Valley on City Tour a few years ago. And then they want to definitely partner with the resorts who are already committed to this, and then schools and hospitals. So this is just the beginning. We just basically said we are on board with this plan, and let's all work together moving forward.
What is a micro digester again?
This one was called Chompy, and I don't know, Parker, exactly how it works, but I know you put in a lot of food and it like smushes it all together, and then it like makes something in the end, and I don't know, it's just all smushy in there. Good question, Parker. I'll come back with what does a microdigester actually do?
The council also got an update from the Trails and Open Space Department, I guess, looking at projects coming up this year. What can you share?
Yeah, so a couple of the big projects we are working on, our trails department is the Meadows and McLeod Creek trailhead parking. That will actually switch to the other side of the road, and there will be a little more parking over there. And then there'll just be some dog mitts, or is that what it's called? Paw mitts, whatever those are called. And we're just going to do a few more things on those trailheads. The Bonanza Flat area, we will finish the Bonanza Flat multi-use trail. And then also at Bonanza Flat, we're going to repair the deck that collapsed from snow, and then create an accessibility trail from the Y. And then we will be replacing some of the rail trail bridges, so people will see that coming. And then, of course, we're always working on wildfire mitigation, which will happen in Treasure, Daly, and Rossi Hill. And then noxious weed abatement. And last, the next couple of weeks, we will still continue Transit to Trails, which is one of my favorite programs that we've implemented.
Yeah, I was really bummed when it got canceled last weekend.
Yeah, it gets windy up there.
Yeah. The council also got an annual update from the HPCA. Just for background, can you kind of explain the contract kind of agreement there between HPCA and with whether it's trash and just with the Main Street businesses?
Certainly. So there's kind of a lot to it, so I'll try to make it a little more compact. But the city is helping fund the executive director position at the HPCA in order for them to help us with things like trash and recycling, and then hopefully this zero waste, for communication, for connecting the businesses to one central location that then can communicate with the city. As we are now in the first 5 days of the water pipe replacement project, they also are very involved in ensuring that this goes as well as we possibly can, and what can we learn from it. For those that don't know, Main Street is closed now from the post office down to Heber Avenue to cars and parking. You can still use the sidewalks and visit your favorite businesses, and we really encourage locals to come out and to support the local businesses on that street. That part of the street will be closed until July 1st, and then next year we will do the same from the post office up to, I think it's about 3rd or 4th Street, and the following year we'll finish it off. So we have a 3-year project that HPCA will be helping us with. And they came in just asking if they had a 1-year contract, and we're just talking about if we're willing to extend that, and then if we could look at doing a long-term contract with them. So that's where we are with that. But yes, visit your local businesses, please, this spring.
Yeah, and I've just gotten some questions on it. Can you explain, why does the city have to do this project?
The water?
Yeah.
Yes. So the pipes are, I think 40 years old.
84.
We've had some pipes burst, and we've had a few issues with that, and we are just getting ahead of this project. So we do need to replace the entire infrastructure of the pipes, and those pipes that run through the middle of the street also connect individually to each individual business. So this is a pretty intense project and does take a lot of resources. And so we just want to make sure that we are providing the best infrastructure to our businesses, and preventing any sort of future issues that might occur. So this is just really getting proactive because of the issues that we've seen before. And as you can imagine, back when they did put these pipes in, they didn't necessarily know if this what the soil was like and if it was going to deteriorate or if it was going to corrode quickly. So we're just really trying to get as proactive as possible.
Yeah. City is hosting an open house on Tuesday. What's that all about?
That will be the last community small area plan. It's the small area plan for the Bonanza Park area. So this is the last community meeting. It will be at 5:30 at the Santee Auditorium. And this is an opportunity for the community to come out and just continue to talk to us about what you want to see in this area. And hopefully we will get all this information and we will be moving as quickly as possible and escalating our processes and just trying to get something done in the 5-acre area, as well as the changes needed to zoning for the small area plan.
Yeah. Anything else you want to mention, Tana?
That's all. Just thanks for a great season. It's been, I can't believe it's already April, and we're hopefully have a few more days of snow, but I'm excited for spring. So thanks for having me, Parker.
Yeah. Have a good weekend.
You as well.
Jumping back into some news. A Treasure Mountain Junior High student is speaking out about what she calls a recent anti-Semitic incident in school. KPCW's Christine Weller reports it happened one day after the findings of a civil rights investigation into the district were released.
On March 21st, a Jewish Treasure Mountain Junior High student said she experienced an act of anti-Semitism during a class. The student, who asked to remain anonymous, said she overheard another student say he planned to draw a swastika in his notebook.
He was thought it would be funny if he left it for the next class open so that they'd find it. And then I heard him say that he wanted all Jews dead or all along the lines of that. So I got up and I left class.
The student said she immediately reported the incident to school counselors. Her dad told KPCW they contacted Assistant Principal Benjamin Mueller, who shared that four students involved in the incident were pulled from class and interviewed. According to the dad, Mueller found multiple swastikas drawn on various items in the students' backpacks, including a large swastika on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. The dad said Mueller also confirmed a student said something like, "We have to kill all Jews." The next day, seven more people were interviewed. The student said she was concerned for her safety after the incident.
I believe that school should be a place you feel safe when learning, and I did not feel safe. I felt targeted.
In a statement, the Park City School District said it can't comment on the investigation because it involves minors. Previously, the district has also said it can't disclose how students are disciplined for harassment. However, this is not an isolated incident. A federal investigation released March 20th found over 180 incidents of harassment based on race, color, national origin, sex, and disability in the Park City School District. Of those incidents, 27 involved anti-Semitism, with 9 occurring at Treasure Mountain. The U.S. Office for Civil Rights reported there could be more unknown incidents of harassment as the district had, quote, inconsistent maintenance of relevant records. Scott Van Hartesfeld is a parent in the Park City School District. After the federal investigation was released at the end of March, he told KPCW he'd like to see the district focus more on education to prevent discrimination and harassment.
Why are specific words so loaded with hate and bigotry tied to, you know, history? I think if you simply provided more of that information and empowered teachers to provide more of that information to our kids, the behavior would self-correct in a lot of cases.
The Jewish student said Treasure Mountain is working on the education aspect. Following the March 21st incident, the student said they learned about anti-Semitism in their weekly advisory class. However, it didn't go as planned.
From what I've heard from other advisory classes, people were laughing during them and not paying attention, and it wasn't taken as seriously as it should be taken.
Van Hartesfeld agrees school should be involved, but to affect change, parents must share in that responsibility.
From a parent's perspective, I think we all are accountable to the outcome here, and we all need to participate in it.
Barry Nan Rothschild, another parent in the district, previously told KPCW the community has a stake in reducing bullying and harassment in schools. She says the Park City School District has not worked hard enough to engage the community to work on solutions.
The problems of the community show up at the school door. So how are we as a school and we as parents going to engage the community in the conversation? And there's been none of that.
The Jewish student's dad believes part of the issue in addressing bullying and harassment may be a fear of retribution. He said district employees might face threats of legal action if they implement more serious consequences for an incident like this or others. Some Park City families, he noted, have ample resources to draw out a court battle. The dad said regardless of the potential outcome, the district would have to spend time, money, and resources to defend itself in court. A district spokesperson said it will share more detailed information and updates on how it complies with the Office for Civil Rights' regulations in the future. KPCW made repeated requests for interviews with Treasure Mountain Junior High School principal Caleb Fine. In an email, Fine said he disputes the characterization of events the student and parent provided to KPCW and said he could not provide further information due to student privacy concerns and federal regulations. Fine offered to provide general information, but only if KPCW guaranteed in advance to air the interview in its entirety. It is against KPCW's policy to make such guarantees. KPCW invited Fine to the local news hour to discuss the incident. At the time of broadcast, he had not responded. A full statement from the Park City School District is available at kpcw.org. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
On the phone with me now, I've got three-time Olympian and founder of Kids Play International, Tracy Evans. Tracy, how's it going?
Great. Thanks so much for having me this morning.
Yeah, before we talk about the event tonight, can you give our listeners some background on what Kids Play International is?
Sure. Yeah, Kids Play International is a sport for development program where we provide after-school programs in Rwanda, Cambodia, and also youth camps now here in Park City and across the U.S. That really help youth ages 7 to 18 build those soft skills that sports so awesomely does, you know, with teamwork and leadership and strategic thinking and all those awesome things that sport really organically builds to help kids really become champions in life, as we call it.
Yeah, what do those youth camps look like? Kind of like summer camp vibe?
Yes, yeah. So they're summer camps, and they really are based off of our Let's Play Fair program that we have as a year-round program in Rwanda and Cambodia. And yeah, they're you know, weekly camps, day camps, where we have all different kinds of sports from flag football and lacrosse and soccer, that really integrate a life lesson within the actual curriculum for that week. So it's obviously about improving some skills in your sports, which, you know, helps to build confidence, but it really is about integrating intentionally a life lesson of respect and contribution, community, things like that, that really help kids to be able to, you know, be more kind to one another and really be able to use those soft skills throughout their life.
Yeah. Hosting a fundraiser tonight, I believe it's 7 to 11 PM. That's at Woodward, correct?
That is. Yes.
And so what's going on tonight? What's the event about?
Yeah. So it's called our second annual Playfair party, and it is all the funds raised tonight will go directly toward our 350 kids in our program to sponsor the kids in our program. And that it's really $300 per child is all it is to really give them free enrollment into our program. It covers all of their education costs from books to school lunches, medical insurance, food and clean water, parent education sessions, and mental health services, free counseling and referral resource networking as well. But what's really unique about it, it's a bartending challenge. So we have four amazing bartending teams that are really our biggest sponsors of the event, because they have been raising funds through their friends and colleagues and companies and all sorts of different channels that we have it's a friendly competition to see who can raise the most money. Ultimately, Kids Play is the ultimate winner because they benefit from obviously all of the funds. But it's a really fun night. We've got an amazing DJ that's come in from Cleveland. So we're going to have some good dancing, some Minute to Win It games. We've got a great silent auction that anyone, you don't need to be at the event to access. You can definitely, there's a link that anyone can go on and look at the silent auction items, as well as we have a trip of a lifetime raffle or opportunity drawing, I should say. And you don't need to be present to win that too. So there's lots of ways, but there are some tickets still available if anybody does want to come, and they can visit our website at www.kidsplayinternational.org, and you'll see a Playfair party button, and you can just click on that and it'll take you right to the event page, and you can contribute any way that you would like.
All right. Tracy, I'm out of time. Is there anything else you want to mention?
Just a big thank you. Honestly, there's a number of amazing teams, which are a lot of Park City local people who have really stepped up to help promote this event and raise funds for Kids Play. So my hat is really off to our red, yellow, blue, and green team, bartending teams. So, I hope everyone can come out and make it. It's a lot of fun.
All right. We've been speaking with Tracy Evans. She's the founder of Kids Play International. Tracy, have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks so much for having me.
Bye. Icon Pass has added a second resort in Switzerland to its list of ski destinations. Pass holders now have 6 European resorts to choose from. St. Moritz in Switzerland is located in the Engadin Valley of the Swiss Alps and hosted the 1928 and 1948 Winter Olympics and 5 FIS Ski World Championships. For the 2024-25 winter season, Icon Pass holders will have access to 7 days at St. Moritz's 9 ski areas with no blackout dates. Icon Base Plus and Base Pass holders have 5 days of access. Icon's other European resorts include Zermatt Matterhorn in Switzerland, Dolomiti Superski in Italy, Chamonix, Mont Blanc, Kitzbühel in Australia, and Grand Val Ria resorts in Andorra. Next winter's Icon passes are on sale. Prices are set to go up on April 19th. Well, thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to the KPCW Local News Hour.